Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And I'm going to take you back a little bit to this time last year. I was at Archon, which is my favorite convention that I go to each year. I got a lot of friends that are there, always like to participate in the different panels and discussions. And I found out in the back of the program who the guest of honor is going to be for Archon in 2025. As soon as I saw the name, Melinda Snodgrass, I knew I not only was going to be at Archon, that is not only happening, but I'm also going as a pro guest. So you're going to see me in a lot of different places throughout the weekend. I also knew I had to reach out to Melinda and invite her on this show. I owe so much to Melinda because as a writer, she is responsible for an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, which many consider one of the greatest of the whole 7-season run. I personally put it in my top 3, and that is The Measure of a Man. From the second season, for those of you looking for necessary viewing episodes of TNG, that is definitely one of them. She has since gone on to work with such greats as George R.R. Martin. She's been an editor in the Wildcards anthology series, which is still in print today and is moving forward in various incarnations, and has book ones of 2 different series, Lucifer's War and The High Ground. I am so excited to have her here. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Melinda Snodgrass. Melinda, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on. Hi, guys. Sitting in my office in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it's a really cold, rainy day here. It's been lovely.
It's actually warmer over here in St. Louis, Missouri. I think we got all the sun today.
Fall has definitely arrived, and everybody thinks that New Mexico is like Arizona, but I'm at 7,000 feet, so I get a lot of Thank you again for having me on.
My pleasure. I'm so grateful that you accepted my invitation, and I'm really excited to see you in person at Archon. I think that's going to be a blast.
Well, this coming weekend.
For those of you who are listening, yes, we are recording this only a few days apart from the episode's launch, so by all means, if you are in the St. Louis/Collinsville area, get over to Archon this weekend. It's going to be a blast. I will definitely be seeing you there. And I know Melinda will too. I look forward to all of this. And I'm really excited. Before we dive in, I need to make a point to say this. Back in the end of 2016, when we collectively lost Carrie Fisher, I made a point to say to myself that if there's anyone who's contributed to my life in a very positive way creatively, I have to thank them. I had a moment with Carrie Fisher, and I did not get to say to her, you're the first person associated with Star Wars that I've met, and I wanted to say thank you. And I obviously will never have that chance again. So, Melinda, for everything you have done for Star Trek, I have to say thank you for that.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. It launched my Hollywood career. Despite it being a very difficult working environment, it still launched my Hollywood career. I worked with some wonderful people, from Ira Bear to Jonathan Frakes.
They truly are great visionaries in this field, in this industry, in this franchise. And I'm so glad that you're able to take a piece of that and claim that for your own. I think that's truly remarkable.
Thank you.
So one of the things that I'm always fascinated with is what I like to call the road to creativity. And that's that time in everyone's life when we experience something or meet someone and it just makes you want to say, I really need to do that. And whatever path you're on, you just kind of get on that exit ramp and you're on a different highway and you're on this road that you feel that this is where I need to be. You started out with a law degree, correct?
Yes, I had always loved science fiction. When I was 7 years old, the first book I read all by myself, my dad taught me to read before I went to school, was A Princess of Mars. Before I could read, he kept reading Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, but he only read the sort of cool adventure stuff. He didn't read all the fish stuff because I was 5 years old. And I think that together with Princess of Mars solidified that science fiction was what I loved. My dad was a very proper businessman when I was, he had been a jazz musician. and he played five instruments and he sang. Then he went on to go into business and make money and have a family. But I inherited his voice. Before I went to law school, I studied opera in Vienna.
Oh, wow.
Really thought I wanted to be a world-class singer. What I learned from school there is that I had a very nice voice, but that 0.1%, that kind of voice that's going to perform at La Scala or the Met, I didn't have. I had a wonderful accompanist who would play for me while I sang. He said to me once, "You really have a brain and you should go back to the United States and finish your education, because you're going to spend your life singing in small operetta theaters because you don't have that kind of voice." And so I made the decision to go home. My dad had always wanted me to be a lawyer. I got in and realized at the end of the first semester, I love the study of law, but I knew this was not where I wanted to be. But I couldn't really quit. And I couldn't bear to sell my dad. And so I toughed it out, finished law school, did very well, passed the bar on the first try, felt like I was obligated to go practice law for 3 years. And I hated it. My best friend at the time was a gentleman named Victor Milan, who all of you at Archon will know and remember. Victor had become a very close friend. We sang together with the Civic Light Opera, and he encouraged me to start writing. So I started writing a novel in secret. Vic would read the chapters. We'd meet up at night. For some unknown reason, we would always meet up at Big Boy on 4th Street in Albuquerque at midnight. And then he would read my chapters and give me notes. And then we got to watch the variety of individuals who would wander through to the Vips Big Boy. And that was something to be witnessed. I ended up in this writing community. New Mexico had this enormous colony of writers. We had Roger Zelazny, Fred Saberman, Susie McKee Charnas, Victor Millay. I just wanted to be a part of that world so badly and not have to be a lawyer anymore. Then I started selling books, so I quit being a lawyer. And I actually owe Star Wars for that. Star Wars gave me the courage to quit. Star Wars got me through the bar exam. I'm old, but I saw Star Wars while I was for the bar exam. I swear it kept me sane. Vic and I got to see Star Wars on opening night and a midnight showing, because they kept having to add showings, lining up around the theater. He and I had a tradition of always going to the opening of every new Star Wars movie together on opening day. It was Empire that, I mean, people laugh at me, like, really, you took advice from a puppet? The puppet. I got to that moment, I was sitting with Vic, and we got to that moment. Stop me if I'm just babbling away here.
Not at all. I'm loving this.
We got to the point where Luke is trying to lift the X-Wing out of the swamp.
Size matters not. Yep.
And Yoda says to him, do or do not, there is no try. I realized that if I really wanted to pursue what I loved, which was writing, I needed to do and not try. So I walked into the law firm the next morning and I quit on the spot. While I was a lawyer, I was still singing with the Civic Light Opera. I was studying ballet. And then I got back into horses because I'm crazy that way.
So you still had the creative fires going.
I did. There's a lot of law in my work, but I couldn't bear that career. If I had gone to work for the ACLU, I might have stayed a lawyer. Yeah. My specialty in law school was constitutional law, which is why I'm having a heart attack right now.
Totally understand.
Yeah, but that was road not taken. I took a different road and I've loved my road.
One of the things I was really fascinated to hear about was the first published work, if I'm not mistaken, was the Star Trek novel.
Yes. Well, actually, confession time. I needed a bills. And so I wrote 6 romance novels under pseudonyms because I could write one in 2 months. While I was doing that, I was working on a big science fiction thing about a federal court judge writing circuit in outer space. But I was having trouble breaking into science fiction. And this very famous editor named David Hartwell, starting up the new Star Trek line. And he said to me, if you want to try to break in, if you'll send me an outline for a Trek novel, I'll take a look at it. So Vic and I came up with Tears of the Singers, brainstormed the plot, and David bought it. It was the first Star Trek novel to go on the New York Times bestseller list.
Wow.
And it was all about Uhura. I loved her because she was fabulous and she was a singer. So I could do a thing about music. that was the genesis of that. But it was interesting because David said to me, after he bought the book and I turned it in and he said, thank you, this is good, and we're going to publish it. He said, I'm going to give you some advice. He said, if you don't want to become a media tie-in writer, never write another one. Because if you write another one, he said, you're going to get shunned onto that thing where you just write media tie-in. And I said, no, I want to write my own stories. So I've never written another one.
A great way to get in. Did Nichelle Nichols ever reach out to you about it?
No, I don't think. I finally got to meet Nichelle like a year or so at Comic-Con before she passed away. I don't think she ever knew about the book. I don't know how much they followed that other side of what was trapping. Yeah.
What was the turnaround time for those? Novelizations have a very quick turnaround time for movies that are ready to come out. They have to go by the schedule of the release date. But when it came to the Star Trek books, they were just churning them out on their own schedules, right?
Their own schedule. Yeah, there wasn't that kind of, we have to hit a deadline. I think I had, I can't even remember, 6 months or 8 months to write it. They were small, like 85,000, 90,000 words. So they went pretty quickly.
It's almost like they played either a single episode or a two-parter.
Exactly. Yeah, they weren't meant to be a big, long, the two series that you mentioned, my book series, I tend to fall in love with characters in The High Ground, which is part of the Imperials. It's a space opera. You meet the characters at 18, and in the final and fifth book, they're in their 50s.
And oh, wow.
The Carolingian series, the first book is Lucifer's War. You meet the character, he's 27, and in the final, the fourth book, he is in his early 50s. And if you're going to do a series, I like to see what happens to the characters, how they grow, how they change, relationships. And so on.
So basically just a one shot doesn't seem very appealing. Like if you're going to dive into a book with a whole new world, a whole new set of characters, you want to see where they go beyond that, correct?
I do. I love to read series. I mean, I've always loved to spend a lot of time in a world that I, whether it was Darkover or the Miles Vukosian books, I just love those.
Oh, and wonderful.
And that was, for me, getting to finish a thing is really important to me, and which is why ultimately I ended up getting my wonderful agent, got back the rights to my books, because right now, sometimes your series get busted, you don't get to finish. And I really wanted to finish. So she got back the rights and I finished both series and I published them under the imprint of my production company, which is Stealing Fire Productions. So
your own production company.
Yeah, I'm a writer producer for Hollywood. So I have my own, I have a subchapter in the company.
We're definitely going to be talking about that as well. One thing that also fascinated me about The Measure of a Man was its origins, because this started out as a spec script, right?
Yes. So my best friend, George R. R. Martin, little known writer, you may have heard of him.
George and I, book or two.
We're very close friends and in a gaming group together. Gaming with George, he is chaos incarnate. But anyway, George had gone out to Hollywood to work first on New Twilight Zone and then on Beauty and the Beast. I got this phone call. It was George. And he says, hey, Snod, I think you'd be really good at the screenwriting thing. And if you want to take a swing at it, I'll show the script to my agent. Well, I thought, okay, sure. So I looked at LA Law, but it looked like it was so minutely plotted that I didn't see how I could slide in. I did not want to write for Beauty and the Beast because I thought it put George in an awkward situation. I mean, if I wrote a really crappy script.
And when you say Beauty and the Beast, you're talking about the series with Linda Hamilton and Ron Perlman, right?
And why have I blanked on his name? Vincent, the guy who played Vincent. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was that Beauty and the Beast, the original, and that George was on. And I, like I said, I didn't want to write a Beauty and the Beast script because I felt like that put him in an awkward position. And I had grown up as a little kid. I had watched Star Trek. So when I saw there was a new Trek, I thought, okay, I'm going to tune in and see what that's like. It wasn't great. But Data was fascinating. I obsessively watched several episodes. I had been a singer and an actor, so I would get the voices in my head. George had given me advice about writing a spec script. People break in differently now than how you broke in by writing a spec script for a TV show that was already on the air.
Right. Say spec script, it means speculative script. You're writing it without the knowledge that it's going to be picked up.
George said to me, you will never, ever sell your spec script. They're just a calling card. They show a potential producer that you can write. If they like the script, they'll have you come in just pitch. Mm-hmm. The other thing that would happen is normally the agent would not send your script to the show you wrote it for. You'd send it to a show that was similar. Because if you send it to a show, everybody on the show knows those characters, and you're never going to get it as precise as they do because they've been living with them. Your agent would say, okay, you've written an LA law script, but instead I'm going to send it to this other lawyer show. If they like your script, George said, they will have you come in to pitch, and you will pitch some other episode ideas. I came up with the idea for The Measure of a Man, which is based on the Dred Scott decision, an infamous Supreme Court decision in which the Taney Court held that a slave who had been brought into a free territory, declared he was now a free man, was not in fact free. He was not a person. He was still the property of his slave owner, and he was sent back. I thought, well, that could be used for data very effectively. But I knew it was a pretty good idea. And I called George back and said, I've got this idea. I think it's really good. Maybe I shouldn't waste it on a spec script that you tell me is never going to sell. George gave me the single best piece of writing advice I ever got, which was never hoard your silver bullet, meaning lead with the best thing you've got, the thing you are most passionate about, and write that. So I wrote The Measure of Man. And then the writer's strike happened. And everybody was on strike for 6 months. And then the strike ended. And I get this phone call from George's agent saying, Star Trek wants to meet with you. I flew out and I had all these little 3x5 cards with ideas for episodes written on them. And I went into Maury's office. And first thing he said to me was, tell me about yourself. About law and singing in Europe and blah, blah, blah.
And that's Maurice, right?
I'm clutching these cards, and I finally say, well, Mr. Hurley, I have some other ideas for episodes. He pointed at a whiteboard over his head, and it had a list of upcoming scripts they were going to shoot. So that was, and then other things happened, and I came back to a notes session with Maury and Rick. At the end of that 3-hour notes session, there were certain things, like I had to come up with a new teaser, which is why I had to come up with the poker game. I had a different opening. At the end of that 3 hours, Maury said to me, this was on a Thursday, he said, I'm hiring you and you start Monday. So that was how I got the job.
It's not even just like, oh, we're going to shoot your script. Here's a check. Thank you very much. You're actually going to stick around. We want you not only for your scripts, you're going to do more than just write scripts.
Right. You're going to be a story editor, which basically means I write scripts and I rewrite other scripts. You rewrite stuff that comes in from freelancers. And you help plot. I mean, a writer's room, if people will be able to see that board behind me with all those cards on it, a movie idea I just broke with a friend. And that's what we would do in the room. We used a whiteboard. I use cards now, but we'd use a whiteboard, different colored pens, plot episodes. That's a lot of your job as a writer. Once a script is cooked, once you have an idea, it's outlined, then your boss is assigned who's going to write it. Normally, the person who comes in with the idea writes the script, but not always. Sometimes you get assigned a script from somebody else's idea because they think you might be the better choice. I was the only woman above the line on the show, so I inevitably got stuck with rewriting the emotional moments. Let's have Melinda rewrite that scene. Thanks, guys. I can write action pretty well, too. But That was how I ended up on Trek.
And during the episode was being shot, were there certain things that were happening during the shoot that you just saw, like different takes that the actors were doing that really grabbed your attention? There was a lot that Jonathan Frakes was doing with just a look here and there. There was a moment, because I rewatched this episode just last night because I wanted it fresh in my head. There's the moment around the second half or so of the episode where he asked the computer for a full diagnostics of Data. And while he's watching it, we're not seeing what he's seeing, but we're watching his face. There's a smile on his face, just like, ah, I got it. And then maybe a second, he catches himself and he's just like, oh, I got it.
No.
What a wonderful moment, especially if what's coming later.
I loved him. It was great.
A great dynamic. Between everyone.
Rick Berman would not permit us on the set. Trek was so weird. Maury took me over once because I was such a new kid and I'd never been on a movie set. He snuck me over one day and I got to watch a little bit of the filming. I thought the biggest high I could ever have was seeing my book on a bookshelf in a bookstore. Nothing compared to standing on a soundstage listening to actors say your lines. That is a whole other level. There was one other time when Ira Bear took all of us over to the set and he got chewed out for it. Trek was not like, when I went on to work on Reasonable Doubts, I learned what a real TV show is supposed to run like. We could go to the set whenever we felt like it. We watched the dailies every day. We were sitting on table readings for scripts we wrote. We were in casting, editing. My boss on Reasonable Doubts, Bob Singer, would have me sit next to him in the editing room while we were editing my episodes. That's where you learn. You could rewrite a script on the fly with a good editor. We were not permitted to do any of that on track. So, yeah, very peculiar show.
There definitely seemed to be a lot of different directions Trek would go in behind the scenes. My understanding is that they had this open door policy for allowing other scripts to be submitted, correct?
Yeah, and it was bad. They would lift ideas from people, and I actually reported them to the Writers Guild once.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I had some issues. As my friend Rick Manning, who I worked with on the show, said, Star Trek put the S and the T in PTSD. And that is actually true. I can't watch the show. I've never watched another. I made myself watch the first season of Picard because it was completely based on Measure of a Man. That is the only, I don't watch Trek. I can't.
One of my top three, another one of my personal favorites was one that I understand was also started out as a spec script, and that was Yesterday's Enterprise. But that was during the third season.
I was still half the second season and all of the third season. I was not involved. In terms of the third season, I rewrote Data's Daughter, whatever that one was called.
Oh, The Offspring, right?
Yeah, I did a rewrite of that script. We rewrote stuff. The one about the, I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, there was a lot of rewriting because that's what you do when you're on now. You know, there are very few freelance writers that get to come in and write scripts anymore because you're not finding new young talent and you're not giving them an opportunity.
Yeah, becoming like a minefield for ideas.
It's harder to break in now. The best way to do it is become somebody's assistant. And then if they ask you if you are interested in writing, you immediately hand them your spec script. I've watched it happen on a couple of shows where an assistant, or we'd have a crisis where a script didn't work out and we were behind schedule. And
wow. That's got to be nerve wracking, but at the same time, it's just like the opportunity has presented itself. Are you going to show up for that? Or are you going to just wilt away?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to break in right now after COVID and the strike. Tough in the industry.
But we also see a lot happening with independent artists. There seems to be more of a DIY feeling with a lot of the movies out there right now because there are different platforms for them. What are your thoughts on those?
I think that's a good way for people to try. Interestingly enough, it's easier to sell a lower budget feature film than it is to sell a TV series. I've got the outline here for a TV series set in Santa Fe, which I'm working on the script. I'm actually writing the spec script for my manager. This movie idea looked like there's a producer who might be interested in it. We're selling a lot to Apple, Netflix, and Amazon, rather than going through the big studios, the Warners and the Paramounts and so on. We're selling directly to these streamer markets with feature films. If you can write something that shoots for under $12 million, you've got a pretty good shot at selling it.
And then for the more micro-budget things, you have a home on places like Tubi.
My young assistant, I mentored him until he became my assistant. He's in college now and a very fine photographer, director, camera work, also a writer. When he finishes, he and I could possibly start doing some stuff and then look at, do you put it up on YouTube? What do you do with these? A lot of studios and producers to see these shorts, see what people are producing. I mean, that's a world I don't know. I tend to write like the 90-minute movie or a one-hour TV pilot.
But. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. During the time that you were working in television, were you also working on your own books at the same time?
I mean, it obviously slowed down my production of books, but George and I were still doing Wild Cards. We were juggling him on Beauty and the Beast, and then whatever his overall deal. And I was working on Trek, and then on Reasonable Doubts. And we're still trying to juggle this big shared world anthology that we co-created and are co-editing.
And I'm really fascinated to hear about how Wild Cards really got together, because just like you said, with the scheduling that you guys had, wild that it was able to actually come together.
Well,
how did that come about?
We started it before either one of us ended up in Hollywood. It grew out of our role-playing games. Vic had given George a copy of a game called Superworld, because George was a huge comic book fan. And George began running Superworld for our gang. It was Walter John Williams and Victor Milan and John Miller, anyway, a bunch of people, Laura Mixon, writers. And we were playing obsessively. We were playing like three nights, four nights a week till 2 or 3 in the morning. And George would stay over at my house because he didn't want to drive home at 3 in the morning. One morning he came out and I handed him a cup of coffee and he said, "We've got to find a way to make money off this obsession." So we created Wild Cards over breakfast at my dining room table. George said, "Let's do it as a shared world. You and I will create the sandbox and then we'll invite our friends to come play." So that was how it began. I mean, we're kind of on a semi-hiatus because we're not quite sure. We've got 36 books out and nobody's going to start with book one. What I normally tell people is read the very first book, Wild Cards, and then jump forward and start with Inside Straight and just skip some, because it's too much.
Yeah.
We had it sold as a TV series to Hulu, but then Disney fully purchased Hulu, at which point we were dead in the water because Disney already owned Marvel. They didn't need another superhero franchise. At the moment, George and I are looking at other options, but nothing has gelled yet. So that's where we are with Wild Cards.
You hope that a streamer does take a shot on that. Yes, Disney has its own Marvel, but everyone is looking for their own Marvel.
There's a lot out there, and they're all feeling like that's played out. Also, we have the problem that the thing that makes Wild Cards unique is the fact we have the Jokers. The alien virus that gives you superpowers can also twist and deform the body. I was one of the executive producers on Wild Cards for Hulu. Just looking at the cost of the makeup, if we shot it like that, we were adapting a book called Fort Freak, which is a police procedural drama. Our main character was going to be in a makeup chair for 3 hours every morning, which meant we only have a few hours to shoot. And if you have to have practical makeup on a whole bunch of people,
it's going to be pricey.
I'm not sure it's affordable as live action.
So with that in mind, would you be opposed to someone saying, "Hey, why don't we try it as an animated?"
No, I'm not opposed at all, but there's a lot of superhero stuff out there. Even though we were early adapters of very realistic superhero stuff, we've had Heroes, which seem to lift a lot from Wild Cards, Boys. So it feels like perhaps our time has passed, but if something comes of it, I would love to write about all the characters, the fun ones that I created. We'll see what happens. Right now, I've got all these other things going on. And George is really busy, too, with his stuff at HBO and the books. So we haven't had a real opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. He's definitely working on all that. And with everyone doing their own thing, what prompted the creation of your own production company?
Mostly it's how to get paid. Studios will not, it's very esoteric. Nobody really wants to hear about tax stuff, but unless you're a subchapter S, you can't do a pass-through in your salary. I had a company, but it was an LLC. With the way the market is going now, I wanted to have my own production company. So I went ahead and my lawyer created a subchapter S, and that became Stealing Fire Productions, which is an allusion to Prometheus.
Stealing fire from the gods, giving it to the people.
We'll see what happens. I have the TV show. I'm developing this movie, and I'm writing 2 novels right now.
It's all under the Stealing Fire banner?
I'm named on the books, of course, but the publisher is Stealing Fire Productions. I did that because it enables my heirs to continue to have the income, but it's in a company, and the company can go on. So,
of course.
The decision I made to put the imprint under the name of the company.
Now, I have to ask for everyone that's listening, because I'm sure there are those looking for any sort of opportunity. Are you accepting submissions from anyone currently or in the future?
No, not right now. It's too much of a risk for a writer, mm-hmm. particularly a Hollywood writer. You run the risk of somebody saying you stole my idea. So read, you know, unless I've sold it, we're set up, we have a system and a studio, then I might be open to submissions. But I can't right now as an individual. It's too much of a risk for a writer. It just really puts you in a bad place.
Right. Just want to make sure that's out there. Don't want to submit.
When Wild Cards first started, it was really hugely popular. We had people sending us their spec stories, and I wouldn't even let George open the envelope, the sender, and send it back. And George went, but I want to see if it's good. And I was like, no.
bad writer.
Hey, you can't do that. It's invitation only for Wild Cards. George and I periodically go, okay, we need some fresh blood. Who do you want? I get to pick some writers. He gets to pick some writers. And then we see if they want to come and join the fun.
That's a smart way to do it.
And you definitely have a sense of knowing what that kind of work is before reaching out to them. Just saying, oh, this would be a good fit. This person, I don't know, but this one would be great for it.
Well, because it's a shared role, we need people who are collaborative, who are willing to work with others. The fun of Wild Cards is you get to let other people use your character, and you get to use other people's characters. But you have to get permission. You have to show them what you do with them. And they have a veto right, because we did not want to end up with what happened with Thieves World. We wanted people to. So we're looking for people. In many ways, George and I think we've gotten better and better at handling Wild Cards from our Hollywood experience. It's like he and I are plotting out the season, and then we invite writers to send us story ideas that carry the plot forward. We plot them in triads, three books. Sometimes we do a standalone. You really want to do a standalone law book. What the law looks like in a world where there's people with superpowers. Because I don't think anybody's really delved into that. So, but George keeps saying, you're the only one who could write for it. And I was like, I can help the other writers.
That's great. So one thing that I always like to know about is if there is someone who feels like they want to delve into something that is more creative, whether it's writing, filmmaking, acting, whatever course that is, they just feel that in their gut that they need to get away from the regular thing they're doing and move into something riskier. But at the same time, it's fulfilling to them because it's been with them for so long. What is something that you would recommend?
Take the risk. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? You've got to go back to your boring day job. It's not like you're going to die, you know, this incredible risk that will risk your life. I would say do it. And the one thing I always say when I teach or when I'm at a conference is writing is the one career where nobody has to give you permission. You can just sit down and start writing. And now with the change in the industry, you don't have the traditional publishing gatekeeping. If you're going to do it well in a writer's group or get some feedback. Make sure it's spelled right and the grammar's good and hire an editor. Be as professional as you can be. The possibilities are out there. My dad was a huge risk taker and always taught me to take a risk. So you do have to be aware that you might end up having to go back to being an accountant. Not a lot of writers make a living now as a freelance writer anymore. Right. A lot of people still have a day job, but you say, okay, I'm going to get up at 4 a.m. I'm going to write for 2 hours at work, or I do it after work or whatever. You might have to do that, but there's nothing that says you can't, that there's nobody saying, no, you're not permitted. I mean, that's a different matter for acting or for making music. If you're a musician, you can record and upload your music. It's become much more democratized than it used to be, I think.
Yeah. That is definitely true. Now, I reached out to you through your website. Are you on social media at all where anyone can chat?
Oh, yeah. I'm on Threads and Blue Sky and Instagram and Facebook. I know Facebook is like old people stuff, but a lot of followers there. I'm perfectly happy for people to get in touch with me, ask questions. I won't read your material, but I will advise you and give you my best advice. We're always learning from each other. I was at a conference and this other guy, another screenwriter, actually, he co-wrote my favorite X-Men movie, which was X-Men First Class.
That's the best one. I'm a huge fan of like the Fox X franchise means so much to me. Like that was something that became a thing for my dad and I.
To me, X-Men Apocalypse, which was just awful. I'm sorry.
It was definitely a step down, and there were some things I liked about it, but overall.
First Class was great.
Yeah. I love Days of Future Past as well.
Well, my friend Lending is in it, so that meant the world to him. But yeah, Apocalypse just nearly broke me. I was like, oh my God. When somebody kills everybody in Cairo, you don't sort of go, well, I'm sorry, that was a big boo-boo. I was like, little cute blonde girl kills her lover and mentor, and everybody just kind of goes, well, you were upset. And I was a lawyer. That is not the Picard we created. Picard would have, she might have been acquitted, but she should have faced justice. And
yeah.
So those kind of things really make me crazy. And that's why Apocalypse made me crazy. But anyway.
Understandable. Understandable. Yeah. I dedicated a whole show to movies like that. I have a show called From Duck Till Dark outside the Marvel Studios. And it's all about all the Marvel movies that are not part of the MCU. And yeah. And so there are quite a few that I love, and there are quite a few that I was not incredibly fond of, but I always find the good in things.
I watch all of them. We were trying to develop it for television. I watched everything. George and I wrote a feature film for Disney of Wild Cards.
Right. I definitely have to say that the main thing you've said is exactly what I hope everyone is doing. Take the risk, take your shot. That feeling that you have within you to get that story out there, whether it's in a book form, whether it's in a screenplay form, whether it is a play, whether it's an audio drama, we have those like as well that are open to us. Whatever the format is, whatever format works best for that story, get it out there, because the one thing you don't want to go through in the rest of your life is regret. You don't want to say, oh, I wish I had done this thing. I wish I had done that thing. We never say that, like, oh, I wish I had one more day at my full-time job. You have to go forth with what is in your gut. You have to push forward. It's something creative. It's something positive that you are bringing. Melinda has done that over and over again in her career. She is continuing to do that. I am so excited to see what is next for her. And I'm really excited to see what is next for all of you. Because as I've said many times on the show, in these crazy times, we need your ideas, your vision, your stories now more than ever. So for Melinda Snodgrass, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. And I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to heesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@heesgotit.com.